Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, August 18, 2017. A South African national is being held by South Sudan's national security for 1 year.
When the shootout began, he wanted to come home. That's why he was at the hotel next to the airport. And they took him from the hotel. What has happened from there, why it happened, we don't know. We have literally so little communication. We are living on whatever we hear or read.
And the chief of the UN mission in South Sudan says South Sudan is among the most dangerous places in the world for aid workers.
This ranking of being the most dangerous country in the world not only reflects the conflict being so intense, but it also somehow reflects an environment of impunity for those who are involved. And this is unacceptable.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A retired South African senior military officer has been held in South Sudan without trial for 1 year. Colonel William Enley was arrested from his hotel room last year. His relatives said they have made repeated attempts to secure his release. Enley's daughter, Gwyneth Enley, told South Sudan in Focus that her father is being held at the national security facilities in Juba. She says family members are worried her father will not be released anytime soon.
We got to speak to him, like I said, 2 Fridays ago, and he sounded all right, but, you know, they surround them, so they can only say what they're allowed to say. But otherwise, absolutely nothing has changed in a year.
When you last spoke to him, what was he telling you about his condition?
He said he's fine. But we were given rules when we speak to him. You may not speak politics. You may not speak any negativity, only positive talks. So he just basically said hi and he's okay.
What is the South African government doing to secure his release? It's almost a year now that he's in detention in South Sudan. Are there any attempts by the South African government to secure his release?
No. And South Sudan was in our country last month. They didn't even mention my father's name. They didn't mention his name. We have a Department of International Relations. They have a mission in Juba, and that we send. I managed to get it right from the month of February to at least be able to send him some money through the government. So they go and see him once a month when they take the money. I'll give you an example. 2-3 weeks ago, we sent them money to take to my father. To date, they haven't taken it to him. Any news I get about my father, I get internationally. They don't help me at all.
To the best of your knowledge, what were the charges that were leveled against your father?
There is no charges. We don't know. They say they're holding him as a political prisoner, but there are no charges. They haven't brought him in front of a court of law.
What was your father doing in South Sudan at the time of his arrest?
He was a security advisor. When the shootout began, he wanted to come home. That's why he was at the hotel next to the airport. And they took him from the hotel. What has happened from there, why it happened, we don't know. We have literally so little communication. We are living on whatever we hear or read.
Who was he working for as a security advisor?
He wasn't really working for him. He was just advising. It was for Rick Masha, who's now being held here in South Africa.
How is your family feeling like staying without their father for 1 year? How is the feeling within the family?
I cannot begin to tell you how it feels. My family is distraught. The day he gets released, I think, is going to be the first time in a year that we actually sleep. It's unbelievable. This whole thing has been a nightmare. It's like you're fighting your own war, because I'm fighting with my government who does not care. I'm fighting with the government in South Sudan to try release him who does not care. And in the meantime, we just want him to come home. That's it.
Was your father part of a union in South Africa? And if so, have you spoken to the union to see if they can pressure the government?
You must understand something. My government does not care about anyone except themselves. A union does not exist for us in here. The only kind of unions we have is working unions. But there's no such thing as we've got a public protector. They ignore my calls. They ignore my emails. There's no help for me here in South Africa, none. The only people that have tried to help me is Amnesty International, which I say they've been They've been, the only thing that's been keeping me going is to know that, you know, there's someone out there putting his name on a list, making people aware, because you don't even hear about my father in our country. If you go to our newspapers or reporters, it goes dead. So every time they speak to Durko, it goes dead. They will not publish anything. They will not say anything. I have nowhere to go in my country.
All right. That's Gwyneth Anley, the daughter of William Anley, a retired South African senior military officer who has been held in detention in South Sudan for 1 year today. The spokesman for South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation says William Anley violated South Sudan's visa rules. Ambassador Maween McCall says Anley will be released once the government finishes its investigation. He says Anley is being treated according to the laws and regulations of South Sudan.
No, any country can accept somebody to just enter the other country without a visa, but not only because without visa, it may be also attached to other things. I don't know exactly. The procedures that as far as they have gone, but what I know, if he is still in detention, of course, he may be awaiting some kind of processes that he has to undergo, and that is a regulation that the country may require also to finish.
The South African mission wrote to your ministry regarding this particular person. His name is William Anley. He's a retired colonel in the South African Army, and there was no action taken.
Well, if the letter just came recently, probably he's under process. I haven't seen it myself, but maybe he's under process. And when the process finishes on the letter that requires the status of the person jailed, then action will be taken on behalf of the individual that the South Africans are, trying to find out. But I can tell you, if he is still in detention, of course, because of the entry of the visa, without visa, I think we'll be just going through normal process to try to find the reason why that individual came to South Sudan, knowing that he should acquire visa prior to coming to South Sudan like any other places.
His relatives are saying that he came to South Sudan together with the former first vice president, Riek Machar. And when they were boarding the plane from Pagak to South Sudan, South Sudanese authorities were well aware that he was on the plane. So it seems like you were aware that he was coming into the country with one of your VIP.
What I can tell you, he was going with Riek Machar on some purposes or some other thing. This is what I say. If it is just an entry, normal entry to the country without visa, of course, that also has to be handled based on the visa requirements. But if he's coming to South Sudan with attached to other political reasons, of course, and that also may go under different investigation that we don't know the limits, how long the investigation will take. But what I'm telling you is that he is just going through the process and he will be released the moment the process finishes. And so this is what I can tell you.
It has taken 365 days for the process, and your law says if somebody is arrested, he should be brought to court within 24 hours.
Well, it will depend what kind of the reason the person was arrested for. You know, there are other political reasons that you can stay more than the required times, but if the reasons of arrest is different, it may also go longer. The matter of fact is that we need to really finish the process on the individual so that he is released.
That's Ambassador Maween McCall, a spokesman for South Sudan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. As the world marks World Humanitarian Day tomorrow, aid officials in South Sudan say for the second time in a row, South Sudan is one of the most violent places in the world for aid workers. More than a dozen aid workers have been killed so far this year, and more than 80 have died since the conflict erupted in 2013. Aid workers gathered today in Juba to pay tribute to their fallen colleagues and to demand that the warring parties stop attacking aid workers. Nabil Biajo has this story for VOA from Juba.
World Humanitarian Day marks the day on which 22 aid workers were killed in the bombing of the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad on August 19, 2003. Among the dead that day was a special representative of the UN Secretary General to Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello. UN Secretary General, Special Representative in South Sudan and ONMIS Chief David Shearer says, South Sudan is beyond a doubt the most dangerous country in the world for aid workers.
I've worked all over the world. I can't think of a more difficult place to work than here, logistically, in terms of the conflict, in terms of the need. It's a sort of a perfect storm in terms of difficulty. And it takes an enormous amount of courage. And I've seen NGO workers in particular, but all types, in trucks and cars and even in canoes, trying to get to the people that they want to help and support.
Shearer says 15 aid workers were killed this year in the line of the duty, and 82 aid workers have been killed since 2013. Deepmala Mahla, country director of Mercy Corps, who represented international aid workers at today's event, says crimes against civilians and aid workers must not go unpunished.
This ranking of being the most dangerous country in the world not only reflects the conflict being so intense, but it also somehow reflects an environment of impunity for those who are involved. And this is unacceptable.
Mahla says aid workers in South Sudan find themselves in harm's way every day.
Me being a country director of a large team of South Sudanese staff who do incredible work taking substantial risks, I am always worried about their security. Have they reached fine? Is all staff accounted for? And aid workers are not only soft targets, but we also have valuable assets. So incidents of looting or attempts for looting our assets and facilities and compounds is increasing, unfortunately.
Mahla says 42 incidents of looting of humanitarian assets have been recorded this year, and 257 incidents of violence against aid workers have been reported. Sergei Tissot is head of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in South Sudan. Tissot says, on many occasions, aid workers are harassed by the warring parties in the country.
In South Sudan, aid workers have been directly targeted by armed actors, harassed, denied access, and subject to beating. On too many occasions, the way in which aid workers are being treated in South Sudan shows a complete lack of respect from all parties to the conflict.
Tissot says that kind of behavior must stop.
We call upon all armed actors to stop targeting aid workers and civilians. Even better, we called for the gun to fall silent.
Reverend Lexon Maku with the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says the warring parties must respect the lives of aid workers and innocent civilians.
Civilian and aid workers caught in conflict are not and must never be target. On behalf of a national NGO community and as a South Sudanese, I would like to appeal to all those involved in armed conflict to put peace first and come together to build a safe home and a nation for our children.
Aid workers here say, despite the enormous risks they face on a daily basis in South Sudan, they remain committed to helping the millions of South Sudanese in need of food, shelter, and medical assistance. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Officials in Imatong State say insecurity is preventing aid agencies from helping farmers produce food to end persistent food shortages. Government and UN Food and Agriculture Organization say the violence prevents farmers from venturing onto their farms to harvest crops and vegetables that would normally feed their families. For VOA News, Tito Justin has more from Juba.
Dozens of members of Etorit Farmers Group sing about the daily hardships they face from chronic food shortages while FAO and CARE International officials distributed seeds of new crop varieties to farmers. Robert Lokang Peter heads the local farmers group called Bedaya, which is being supported by the FAO. He says farmers who fled their village during fighting between government and rebel forces have left behind large tracts of farmable land that used to produce food for Toriti residents.
The next challenge is insecurity now because we have 10 acres behind us here. We have that 10 acres, but we cannot reach. That we abandon that land. We would have been to be that site. It could be better than this.
Officials confirm many farmers left the rural areas and moved to Torit town to escape insecurity in recent months. Farmers say they are afraid to return to their farms about 10 kilometers from Torit town because others have been harassed by armed groups along the way. Farmer Mary Peter fled her Yari village due to fighting. Speaking Arabic, she says she now lives in Torit and farms a small piece of land.
I moved away from that area because it's insecure. That land is not accessible to us at the moment because there are armed groups, and it's not good to continue to live there.
Although Peter would like to cultivate more crops, she does not have the land to do so. Both FAO and CARE International help support displaced farmers like Peter by giving them seeds and tools to produce vegetables, including tomatoes, eggplants and cabbages, which they sell in the market to earn a living. Johnson Kenyi Simon, the state director of agriculture, says government soldiers often prevent farmers from accessing rural areas because they think it is not safe for civilians to venture out. He says they are also suspicious.
When you go out, you become probably prudent. They say, why did you go out there? If you are a farm like this one in the Inyi, where we are cultivating, you go beyond there, when they will be patient. Have you gone to them now? Then you will be complicated that you are taking messages to those guys.
Alfred Gwarit, a FAO agriculture officer in Torit, says the violence in rural areas makes it dangerous for farmers to earn a living and feed their families.
At the moment, people are only confined to their own homesteads with a small kitchen garden around. That's why you find them just cultivating around the household because they can't go far. If they go far, they are fearing insecurity. Anything can happen in terms of those who are outside attacking people.
Torit resident like Mary Joseph says the food security situation in Torit continues to deteriorate. Speaking Arabic, Joseph says many roads that farmers and traders normally use have become too dangerous to travel.
Food used to come from Yeri about 15 kilometers from Torit town, but after the conflict, Yeri road was forced to close. Our situation is bad.
Joseph says if the road to Uganda opens, they will have access to vegetables, but only if they can afford to buy them. Famine was declared in parts of South Sudan earlier this year. The FAO warned that unless South Sudan's leaders end the conflict, it will be nearly impossible to improve the food security situation in the country. The FAO also said more than 4 million South Sudanese are food insecure and many women and children are at risk of starving. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, vulnerable South Sudanese children in refugee camps get a second chance to stay in school. That story is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
was there a time when you didn't have enough to eat? How did you cope?
Yes, there was a time, many times, when I didn't have what to eat. Normally, I do run to friends or sometimes relatives to help me out.
I slept, and when I woke up, took a lot of water. I slept for a very long time, like 6 hours in the day. So I didn't feel the hunger. So when I woke up, I drank a lot of water again.
Several times, yeah, because given our situation, the moments that you really barely have anything to eat. But again, the word of God is clear. Man does not live on bread alone. In some situations, one has to adapt. You have to understand that.
The university, my morning orphanage. So what did I do? I went to a friend's room and pretended I was going to visit. There was food and I took some.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese children at Pagrinya refugee camp in northern Uganda who drop out of school because of fighting in their areas say they intend to work hard after getting registered in learning programs at the camp. Simon Peter Apiku has more for VOA from Adjumani.
The Accelerated Learning Program, or ALP, is a fast-track education program designed to enable South Sudanese school dropouts between the ages 12 and 17 to continue their education in Uganda. The program compresses Uganda's 7 years of primary school education into level 1, 2, and 3, which means students spend 3 instead of 7 years in primary school. Pagirinya camp teacher Hamis Williams says some students who were enrolled in the program could not attend classes for various reasons.
Some of the children are left out because of the condition. Others are unable to pay for the examination fee or registration fee. And because they came here without their parent separated, some of them are orphan. Others are child-headed family. Some of them are child mothers.
Esther Bayua, a level 3 student at the center, dropped out of school in 2013 because she became pregnant. The 22-year-old Bayua says she lost hope of receiving an education until she heard about ALP for school dropouts at the camp.
I'm one of the child mother. I've dropped out from school. They've taken 4 years. And when I dropped out of school and I heard that one of the organizations came with the idea that those who are not dropped out from school should come back to school because their age is still young and they can school. That's why I came and I joined this school.
Doma Richard is a 14-year-old orphan taking classes at the center. Richard says he dropped out of school after his father died and his mother abandoned him.
My father is dead. No one is paying my school fees. I stayed with my grandmother. Now my grandmother cannot get money.
Lemia Charity, a child mother who had her baby when she was 15 years old, was also forced to drop out of primary 5 classes in South Sudan. Charity enrolled in the camp's fast-track program after her grandmother agreed to take care of her child, but it still has not been easy.
The person who take care of my baby is my grandmother, my mother's mother. My real mother has died. This is the problem where I'm facing. Sometimes my grandmother is breaking anger call and abusing me that even I leave school, I get pregnant, even now my baby is disturbing her.
Charity says as a single child mother with no source of income, she's often forced to sell part of the food rations she receives from the World Food Program in order to buy necessities for herself and her child.
Sometimes if I get ratio, I will sell that ratio to get soap and to wash baby clothes. And sometimes if the baby falls sick, you'll come to the health center. Sometimes there is no medicine there.
William says teachers try to help the children realize their dreams, but admits conditions at home often hinder the students from performing well at school.
They were talking about coming here, going late and preparing for them meal, fetching water, looking for firewood, other domestic work is occupying their time, and some of them do not have sources of light for revision, and others have no reference book for revising, and some of them don't have proper shelters.
Despite the challenges they face, Bayua says she plans to study hard and become an accountant. Richard says he hopes to become an engineer and Charity plans to become a nurse. Level 3 students become automatic candidates for primary living examinations, and those who do well join regular secondary school classes. More than 130 children attend Pagirinya Camp's ALP Center, which is supported by the British-based NGO Save the Children, which receives funding from the European Union. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Piku in Adjumani.
Analysts say there were some unexpected poll results in Kenya this year, including the ruling party's success in gubernatorial and parliamentary races and an increase in women and youth being elected at local levels. They also question whether the $483 million that Kenyan taxpayers spend on a digital election was worth it. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Nairobi roads have returned to their usual pre-election bustle, and Kenyans have gone back to work.
But the elections are not quite over, as opposition leader Raila Odinga insists the presidential poll was stolen and has announced plans to challenge the outcome at the Supreme Court. Official results show President Uhuru Kenyatta defeated Odinga 54% to 45%. University of Warwick Professor of Comparative Politics Gabrielle Lynch says most people expected a tighter presidential race, although she notes the final result is still in dispute. Lynch also notes the ruling Jubilee Party succeeded in gaining parliamentary seats and winning 28 of 47 governorships. She says a projected wave of independent winners failed to materialize.
Due to alleged problems with party nominations, both in the opposition and in Jubilee, in a number of constituencies and counties across the country, independent candidates stood against party candidates, and there was a prediction that quite a few of these people might win. Actually, very few independents won in the end.
Kenya's treasury says the government allocated $483 million for the election, with $415 million directed to the Electoral Commission, known as the IEBC. Kenyan researcher Nanjala Nyabola says despite these large sums, there still were problems with the voter registry, the transmission of vote counts, and a delay in the release of polling station tally forms.
We were promised a digital election. We didn't have a digital election. The only thing that was digital was the voter registration. Everything else was 100% manual. So it makes you wonder, what did we spend all this money on?
1 week before the election, the Electoral Commission's head of IT systems, Chris Masondo, was found tortured and murdered. Schaefer Okore, a program officer at political engagement organization Siasa Place, says the lack of follow-up is concerning.
Investigations, I don't think they're being done, or if they are, I don't know who's doing it. Nobody wants to answer why this man was killed or murdered. And allegations have come across that he held such a senior position in regards to the process that was being supposed to be conducted. And we don't have answers. Why was he killed?
In addition, police killed at least 28 people in post-election violence, including a young girl and a baby, according to Kenya's National Commission on Human Rights. Kenya's Independent Police Oversight Authority says they are investigating these cases. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's our show for this Friday. We'll leave you with the song Urukundu by Kidum.
Zanyani mbali kuno kuno mbona Nabonyuru kundari maindagu Nabonyaru findo Nakunzu morondo Nabwemba ngisese Sinamubu inga nubu menyini tangisikanwa Temera kubiki matichu kundo Temeru rufu kwa banu Femera, si lo quisiera muro kundo, fukani
kundo, satuveru kere,
muro kundo, muro kundo,
satuvera ushikira manji kwa kifu mabasi,
muro kundo,
kundo, satuveru kere,
waru kundo, waru kundo kukutizo,
satuvera ushikira manji kwa kifu mabasi, mamera pare ni keramye.
Kirato, kikahengama, wima, wisonze, shukuni mukanda.
We have been listening to Kidum with the song Urukundu, which means love in Kirundi. I am John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. We would like to hear from you what you think about the show. Our email is SouthSudanInFocus@voanews.com. Find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Have a safe weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Urukundo,